Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
From KQED News, I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is special live coverage of today's historic Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision. In a 2-1 ruling, the court struck down Proposition 8, California's ban on same-sex marriage. And this hour, we're going to dig beneath the headlines a bit and hear how both sides are reacting to this ruling in support of same-sex marriage. And we begin here in the studio with Rory Little. He's a professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law. Professor Little, it was an 80-page decision, about a 40-page dissent or so. What stands out for you?
Well, what stands out, first of all, is that the court affirmed the district court's very careful order striking down the proposition on constitutional grounds after a long trial with an evidentiary record. So the court, it's in a good position. If you want to take this to the Supreme Court, it's in a good position to take it. The court attempted to say it was a narrow decision restricted to California, and they base it on the withdrawal of rights to marriage that were established in California for a few years prior to that by a California Supreme Court opinion.
It was a few months, really, right? You're talking about the California Supreme Court decision between then and the election.
Yes,
of
right.
2008.
Yeah, so, I mean, but they do base it on the idea that it withdrew a right that had previously been available, and so it's within the four corners of a case called Romer versus Evans, which is an attempt to cabinet by precedent. And then you have a dissent. Here it's 2-1. It's not unanimous, although the dissent concedes a large number of points that are important for the plaintiffs in the case, that are important to the opponents of Prop 8. So the dissent is not the sort of rhetorically vitriolic dissent that you might have seen, say, from Justice Scalia.
Now, you say that, as you pointed out, the court in its majority opinion today said it is a narrow decision because it doesn't do what Vaughn Walker did in 2010 when he declared that marriage was a fundamental civil right that should be available to all Americans, gay or straight. So why are you saying they specifically did not do that today? So why are you saying this is not a narrow decision?
Well, it's not narrow in the sense that the rationale that they use today, which is to say there is no rational basis for distinguishing between same-sex couples and heterosexual couples on the basis of marriage, on that aspect, that there's no rational basis for that. That is an argument that can be used in every challenge with regard to gay marriage across the United States, and attempting to restrict it to withdrawing a right as opposed to denying a right is not persuasive on doctrinal grounds because both of those instances would be evaluated by a rational basis test. So I actually think it's the difference between a 5-lane highway and a 6-lane highway. They're both pretty broad.
Let me bring in Kate Kendall. She's a director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights. She's also with me here in the studio. And Kate Kendall, as you read this decision, do you see it as striking a broad blow for gay and lesbian rights, or is it more cautious?
Well, I think I agree with Professor Little that in terms of doctrinally standing for the proposition that we should not be about a system of laws in this country where we take an entire category of people and say that they can be denied something very important like the right to marry. However, the court did really, by focusing on Romer and by focusing on this elimination of a right that had been extended, that is unique to California.
And let me just say that Romer was the 1996 decision, 6-3 ruling striking down Amendment 2 in Colorado, which basically banned legal protection for gay and lesbian folks. That was passed by the voters, correct?
And what was important about that ruling is the court said, look, when you look at the justification for passing that amendment, Amendment 2 in Colorado, the court couldn't find any reason to justify such a broad disability executed against LGBT people except for the fact that the voters don't like LGBT people. And what the court found here, similarly with Prop 8, the only reason to eliminate the right to marry from this one category and only this category of people had to rest in dislike or opprobrium with LGBT people, and that's not a sufficient basis for denying a fundamental right.
All right, and I want to go now to the both sides of the legal teams that argued this case, both before the trial court and again before the Ninth Circuit, and we begin with the winning side. Theodore Boutrous is an attorney for the No on 8 legal team, and he joins us from San Francisco, where he just recently wrapped up a press conference on this topic. Ted Boutrous, good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Scott. Thank you.
You and your colleague, Ted Olson, said at the very beginning that marriage is a fundamental right that has been expressed time and again by the U.S. Supreme Court and should therefore be extended to same-sex couples. The court today did not say that. Are we disappointed in the scope of the ruling?
We are extremely pleased with this ruling. The court applied the Supreme Court's precedents in a way that I think is unassailable in terms of its logic, its correctness. I think Professor Little had it right in terms of the rulings here and how they would apply in other states. And if the Supreme Court reviews this case, we are very confident because of the way the Ninth Circuit applied Romer and other decisions that they will find the same thing, that stripping away rights from gay men and lesbians simply because of who they are violates equal protection. And if you walk through the opinion, the rationales that the proponents of Proposition 8 offered at trial and in public are demolished by the Ninth Circuit. The protect our children rationale, the court takes that apart and shows just how baseless it is. And the findings that Judge Walker made, the record that we made and that the proponents of Proposition 8 failed to make is there for all to see. So we are extremely pleased. This is a strong ruling, and in terms of the issues the court didn't reach, that's how constitutional cases are made. That's how rights are recognized nationwide. So we appreciate how the court dealt with the issues and laid the groundwork, paved the way for marriage equality in this nation. And this ruling, when other states recognize marriage equality, for example, New York, and then forces like the proponents here come in and try to take those rights away because of who the people are in those states, this decision says no. The U.S. Constitution won't allow that.
Let me ask you a question. This was a three-judge panel. It was ideologically diverse. Stephen Reinhardt, appointed by President Carter, widely regarded as the most liberal judge in the circuit, if not one of the most liberal judges in the country. Michael Hawkins, appointed by Clinton, a moderate. And then Randy Smith, appointed by George W. Bush, the conservative. He dissented today, and I'm wondering if you don't feel, he did point out this legitimate, rational interest the government has in promoting what he described as responsible, optimal parenting and procreation. Is that not something for the Supreme Court to hang its hat on?
Well, there, number one, there was no evidence that supports that rationale. Two, as the majority found, here the other laws in California demonstrate that's not a legitimate purpose and one that wouldn't be affected by Proposition 8. But the evidence was overwhelming. And in fact, the plaintiff's own, the proponent's own expert, Mr. Blankenhorn, basically admitted that it would be better for children, it would be better for families, for marriage to be permitted. And so I don't think that's a rational basis. In Proposition 8, there's absolutely no basis for thinking that it would promote responsible parenting. Gay men and lesbians are allowed to have children and be parents. Allowing them to marry only fosters a better environment, a better atmosphere, and recognizing the dignity and value of every family, of every couple, is the best way to promote parenting and family. So I don't think that rationale will hold up. It didn't hold up at trial. There was no evidence of it. And it doesn't make sense given our society today.
I know that your legal team is prepared for any eventuality here, but would you prefer to see it skip this en banc review by the Ninth Circuit and go right to the Supreme Court? Or do you feel there's a benefit in one way, going having it go one way or the other?
We are, as you said, ready for anything. The Ninth Circuit has been seeking to help move the case along, but we had the detour into the California Supreme Court on standing. So we're anxious to get this case resolved. So if the next stop is the Supreme Court, we're ready for that. And I haven't been able to tell. Maybe your next guest can tell us if the proponents are going to seek en banc review. But we're ready to wrap this case up so people can get married and this discriminatory law will be off the books.
All right. Theodore Boutrous, part of the No on Prop 8 legal team. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And let's go now to Andrew Pugno, who is general counsel for ProtectMarriage.com, the folks backing Proposition 8. Andy Pugno, good to have you with us tonight.
Good evening.
Let me ask you to respond to this, what we just heard, that this is really a great decision to get the lower court decision affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you agree that this is not the decision you were looking for?
Well, it's certainly not the decision we were looking for, but it's certainly not a surprise given the makeup of the court and kind of the nature of the way this case has gone. And we've really, since the beginning, I think all agreed on both sides that ultimately this is something that the Supreme Court is going to have to deal with, so we have to go through each of these steps on the way there. But I do think that, I've listened to some of the comments, and I'm looking at the opinion in front of me, and it's saying here that if the court couldn't have resolved this on the narrow grounds that it did, then they wouldn't have hesitated to get to the broader question, the constitutionality of denying same-sex couples the right to marry. So this decision on its face says that it is not deciding whether there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage.
Let me ask you about the next steps, because you do have the option, I think, within 14 days to file a petition to ask a larger panel from the Ninth Circuit to review this case. What are your thoughts about that? How are you going to make that decision?
Well, that decision is going to be made by really closely scrutinizing the majority opinion and the dissent and conferring as a legal team. But we're going to take a couple of days to make that decision. We could go that way, or we could go directly to the Supreme Court. And a third option that hasn't gotten a lot of attention is that any judge on the Ninth Circuit who thinks that this decision came out the wrong way can call for a vote of the judges on the Ninth Circuit, and they may, on their own, decide to pull this back and assign this to an 11-judge panel that would essentially rehear the case.
What are your considerations? What are the factors that you're going to take into account before you make that decision in a few days?
Well, those are something that we need to discuss internally as a group. And I mean, so we're not going to just kind of have that discussion, for all sides to hear. But I think one of them is, the sooner that the voters can get some resolution on whether their vote is going to count and whether the election results are going to be upheld.
But their vote counts now in the sense that Prop 8 is the law of the land here.
Well, it is now. But if ultimately if the end of this case is that the what the voters did is struck down as unconstitutional, then their vote has essentially been nullified. And that's a source of frustration for California voters, to go to the ballot box, to vote on a measure, and then to have it have that interfered with and their judgment substituted for the personal views of a judge.
And let me just ask you a question about time, because some might say that, the longer this drags out, public opinion is shifting. It's moving towards support for gay marriage. Washington State this week is expected to vote on it. The governor up there says she'll sign it. Wouldn't you just as soon get this to the U.S. Supreme Court more quickly?
Well, I would first of all challenge the idea that there's this, inevitable shifting of public opinion in favor of same-sex marriage. Remember that every time that the voters in every state have been given an opportunity to vote, they have always sided with traditional marriage. And so the legalization of same-sex marriage in the handful of states where they're experimenting with it has, in most cases, either been imposed by the courts
implemented by the legislature.
Implemented by the legislature in denying the people the opportunity to vote on that. So that's an important thing, and I think that we just have to remember this was just a couple of years ago. This was an election with a 5-point margin where the voters of California, after a huge campaign and lots of discussion, ultimately sided with traditional marriage, and that should be, remembered and entitled to some respect.
All right. Andrew Pugno, general counsel of ProtectMarriage.com, the Yes on 8 side. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Kate Kendall, a quick reaction from you, this notion that, he does have a point that voters have never really supported same-sex marriage. Is there a risk of this being seen, painted, spun, however you want to say it, as a liberal court imposing its will on the people when the people have voted the different way?
Well, and folks like Andrew Puño have already done a great deal of rhetoric around that very point all day today, and that will certainly continue. Romney himself has weighed in and said, you know, unelected judges. I feel like I want to throw all these guys back into a civics class. This is what it means to be in a constitutional democracy. We have three branches of government. The legislature gets to make some decisions. We're a representative democracy. Those are the people we vote into office in New York. These are the legislators who voted for marriage in New York. We have courts that are a check on either the legislature or the tyranny of the majority. Sometimes the majority, with passions of the time or with prejudices of the time, are not going to get it right, which is why we never before have put civil rights up to a public vote. And I think to assert that somehow the voters are being denied a right, that they should have their right protected to exercise their prejudices against a whole group of people for no reason other than they don't like those people, you know, that runs counter to what it means to be in a democracy.
Professor Little, the author of this opinion today is Stephen Reinhardt, who we said is a very liberal judge. Is that a liability, do you think? He is probably has one of the highest reversal rates of circuit court judges, I would think, in this country.
Well, it's interesting. He doesn't have a high reversal rate if you count every opinion he authors, because they only reverse a couple. But certainly he has more reversed than some other judges.
And high-profile cases, too.
He's a red flag for the Supreme Court, and we can't ignore that. On the other hand, he wrote, I think, a very constrained opinion. And I don't think Michael Hawkins, the other judge in the majority, was silent in that process. I think that this opinion reflects a fair amount of moderation. And the dissent here, I do want to talk about the dissent. Randy Smith is a really intelligent, good lawyer, and his dissent is not a vitriolic attack on gays or the right to marry. This may be the sort of dissent that actually speaks a little bit to the center of the Supreme Court. This may be a more effective dissent. So the idea that you would want to go en banc, you wouldn't do it unless you thought you could do better. Now, the odd thing in the en banc process in the Ninth Circuit is you don't get a vote of the full court. You only get a vote of 11 judges, which is randomly selected. You could get lucky and draw a panel of all conservatives.
And what difference would it make if they went the other way?
Well, I don't know that it would make any difference. I mean, which is one reason to either bypass the en banc stage, or if you're a judge on the Ninth Circuit, no matter how you feel, to vote to deny it, because you're not going to really develop the positions any better than they've been developed by these two judges today. So I do think this is likely to go to the Supreme Court. Yes, I think Stephen Reinhardt attracts their attention, but I think in this case it wouldn't matter who had written it. Had Hawkins written the same opinion, I think the Supreme Court would still be just as interested.
That's Rory Little, a professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law. He's with us this hour, along with Kate Kendall, executive director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights. We're talking about today's historic ruling by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, striking down Proposition 8. And we do want to hear from you as well. This is a topic, obviously, that raises a lot of passion. And our number, if you want to join us this hour, is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's community@kqed.org. Again, community@kqed.org. Or you can go to our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/kqednews. Well, this case is known as Perry. Initially, it was Perry v. Schwarzenegger. Now it's Perry v. Brown. And I want to bring in one of the plaintiffs, Chris Perry, who joins us by phone tonight. Chris Perry, welcome.
Thank you, Scott.
It has been a long road. It's been 3.5 years since Proposition 8 passed. How has this issue, affected your family as it's gone up and down and through the courts?
Well, it's actually made us more and more convinced that we are pursuing the right solution to this problem. Marriage equality can only be solved at this point in California through the courts. We have waited 3.5 years for today's ruling. We are extremely pleased with it. It's a momentous day for us, and we are celebrating something important for California and hopefully for the whole country.
as I don't know if you've had time to read the whole ruling or part of it. I know you were in L.A. this morning. But, you know, as you did read the dissent or as you've heard about it, where the judge, Judge Smith, said that the government does have a rational interest in promoting what he described as optimal parenting, one father and one mother. How do you and your partner, Sandy Steer, how do you react to that?
Well, when I did read that portion of the ruling, the first thing I thought was, what evidence did they put on in court during trial to prove that point? And I couldn't think of any. When they spoke about parenting and they tried to make the case that parents, heterosexual parents, were superior to same-sex parents, there was little to no evidence given. And instead, I have my own life to use as an example and those of my friends, and I see lots of good parenting. And I read the research and listened to the research of the experts brought in for our side, and they provided literally reams of paper and numerous journal articles, peer-reviewed journal articles from numerous universities that stated that not only are parents, the same-sex parents, good parents, in many cases they're doing an even better job because they're facing such adversity that they're overcoming additional adversity as parents.
I know it's been a long day for you. I'm going to let you go, but I think you're going to hand the phone off to one of your fellow plaintiffs, Jeffrey Zerillo, who is there with you. Is that accurate?
I would love to. He's right here.
Chris Perry, thanks so much.
Okay.
Jeffrey Zerillo, are you with us?
Hey, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So it's been, as I said, 3.5 years since Prop 8 passed. Are you still interested in getting married?
No, we're absolutely still interested in getting married. And so far, we're 2-0.
2-0 in the courts. How did you view today's ruling? It wasn't, I'm sure all of you would have preferred a unanimous ruling, 3-0. How did you see it?
Well, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, in our conversations with Ted and the rest of the team, we feel really comfortable with today's ruling, regardless if it was 2-1 or 3-0. It was a thorough ruling, and it did what we expected it to do, and it did what the job of the judiciary is, and the job of the judiciary is to protect the minorities from the majority when people's when people's rights are put to a vote. That's just not acceptable in this country, and that's when the court is supposed to step in and right it.
How involved are you and your partner, Paul Khatami, in this case at this point? I mean, do you just sort of get briefings every now and then from the attorneys? I mean, this has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, we get regular briefings from the attorneys. It's something we're very passionate about, just like Chris and Sandy. We want to know what's going on. Our names are attached to this case, and we feel a responsibility to make sure that we are informed and that we can go off and help educate other people and have thoughtful conversations about what this case is about. And this case is about equality.
All right. Jeffrey Zerillo, thanks so much for joining us. As I said, it's been a very long day for you, and I appreciate your coming on tonight.
Thanks for having us on.
You bet. Again, the number to call if you want to join us this hour, 866-733-6786. Rory Little, what did you make of, in the dissent today, Randy Smith really focusing heavily and quoting from the decision from the California Supreme Court when they upheld Proposition 8?
Well, Judge Smith, I think, did a great job of trying to present the other side of this case without descending into any rhetoric that would support the idea that this was actually an attack on gays. The California Supreme Court was careful in its decision here when they said, we have to uphold Proposition 8, it's the will of the people, even over our own ruling that there was a constitutional right in California to marry under the privacy clause of the Constitution. I think they were trying to steer a moderate course in this very, Kate's right, this sort of tripartite system that we've designed, judicial, legislative,
and executive.
So the executive part to me is an irony. The idea that Jerry Brown has his name on this opinion as the defendant when he's unwilling to defend the law strikes me as a great irony of history, and I'm sure he's going to be happy about that. I think Judge Smith, actually, though, his dissent does not endorse the position that this is a legitimate, rational basis. His dissent says pretty carefully, I can imagine why the legislature or the people might think it's legitimate, and I am counseled as an unactivist judge not to interfere with that determination by a majority. It's a very responsible, if you will, moderate position. We don't overturn laws just because we disagree with their policy.
Especially when it involves the voters.
When it involves the voters. So, I mean, he's steering a very careful course. I imagine, actually, the proponents of Prop 8 are disappointed that he didn't more authoritatively embrace their rationale. What he does is he distances himself from the rationale, but then says, I don't think the federal judge's role is to overturn this. It's you know, you have to go back 45 years to Loving versus Virginia. In Loving versus Virginia, the Supreme Court struck down a ban on interracial marriage. One of the arguments in that case was, regardless of how what you think of the interracial marriage, children in interracial marriages have a harder time because it's so difficult, it's stressful. And the Supreme Court said, you know, that is not a rational basis to deny this right to be married, whether it's a fundamental right or just an important right. So I think we're at an equally historic moment right now. We're saying, well, what is your rational basis? And so far, the judges that have confronted this haven't endorsed any rational basis.
And Kate Kendall, in that regard, the facts of the trial, the testimony in the trial, didn't have a lot of weight on the side of what is the rationale? What is the basis for denying same-sex couples the right to marry?
Yeah, that observation is exactly correct. And in fact, Ted Boutrous sort of touched on this, and which is why, while I appreciate the moderation in Judge Smith's dissent, it's made up out of thin air. None of the evidence that he cites to, that it's about procreation, that kids do better, that's the optimal situation, that is essentially his assertions having no basis in the actual evidence that was presented at trial. There was none of that there.
Well, Rory Little, aren't the appeals court judges supposed to really stick to the facts of the trial?
Well, they are. This area of rational basis has got cases going in all directions, which is why this is a candidate for the Supreme Court.
And maybe we should just quickly explain the distinction between rational basis and strict scrutiny.
Well, so that's exactly right. The Equal Protection Clause basically says if there's a fundamental right involved, we're going to give it very strict scrutiny. We're going to question every rationale. We're going to dig very deeply. And we're not going to sustain a lot of laws that impact negatively on a fundamental right. But if it's not a fundamental right, we're only going to ask, could the legislature have rationally come to this decision, even if we think it's not right as a matter of policy? And Judge Smith, in his defense, there are cases that say the legislature doesn't need evidence. We don't need evidence, so long as we can imagine a rational legislature. Now, there are other cases that say, no, you actually have to make a rational, logical connection. You know, banning gays from being married doesn't improve their parenting.
And in the Romer case that was cited today, the 1996 Supreme Court ruling striking down Amendment 2 in Colorado also relied on that rational basis, right? Anthony Kennedy wrote that opinion and said there was no rational basis for discriminating against gays and lesbians.
That's right. And you know what's important about Romer versus Evans? There's a later case, Lawrence versus Texas, which strikes down criminalizing homosexual sexual conduct. Both of those cases were 6-3, not 5-4. And Justice O'Connor writes a separate equal protection theory in Lawrence versus Texas, which supports this majority opinion today, I think, as strongly as Romer versus Evans. So, you know, I mean, just looking ahead, I'm sorry, but you have to look at, we've got four new justices since these cases were decided, and I don't think Chief Justice Roberts is a foregone conclusion as a negative vote on this one.
Why do you say that?
Well, to be frank, experience shapes your views. And Chief Justice Roberts, among other things, not only has he had his whole professional career in liberal Washington, D.C., conservative though he may be, he and his wife have adopted two children. They understand that there is a non-traditional model for parenting, which can be quite effective. They understand that there can be bias against non-biological parenting. He may be open to the idea that you got to give us a strong connection before we're going to let this happen.
We are talking about today's historic ruling by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, striking down Proposition 8. Let's go to the phones. And again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. And Steve in Oakland, you're up first. Good evening.
Yeah, hey, good evening. Thanks for taking my call. We were talking to work today. Everyone's been kind of assuming that the Supreme Court's going to take this thing. But we were talking about work today about how it, you know, it's kind of a hot potato for them. And I just wanted to ask the panelists, what do you think the chances are that the Supreme Court denies review and just lets this operate in California? And do you think the decision today makes that more or less likely to happen, the fact that maybe it was a little narrower than it could have been?
Kate Kendall, good question, Steve.
Okay, well, Steve, I love wherever you work, and I love that these are the conversations you were having today. You know, this is where Professor Little and I may disagree a little bit. We were talking before the show started. I actually thought all along that there was a theoretical possibility that the U.S. Supreme Court would deny review of a case upholding the Judge Walker's ruling and striking down Prop 8, because Prop 8 is so unique. There's no other place in the country where couples were getting married and then that right was eliminated by the voters. There are other cases, there are other states that have constitutional amendments prohibiting recognition of same-sex marriages, but Prop 8 is a very unique circumstance. And generally, the court needs to see sort of a mix of dispute between states or between circuits before they agree to review a case. So because of that, I think the court could easily say, you know, California is so unique and Prop 8 is so unique that we're not going to review it. I actually have moved my feeling on that from a theoretical possibility to now maybe sort of a 50-50 chance, because I do think, especially with this ruling, which makes clear it's only California and it's only Prop 8, you know, I think you could see not getting four votes, the four votes that you'd need to review from this U.S. Supreme Court, because neither side, neither faction can be sure how it would come out.
Rory Little, I know you've clerked for several U.S. Supreme Court justices. How do they think about that when they're deciding whether or not to grant review?
Well, I mean, we should say a couple of things. First, they think about it differently. That is, different justices have different views. This particular court is not a court that has shied away from cases because they're controversial. They were willing to decide Bush versus Gore. They were willing to decide Citizens United. They like jumping into public controversy. They're going to take on national health care. They don't let things perk too long. And I do think this case is perfectly poised to be decided by the Supreme Court. You're not going to have another case that has such a trial record, has such a well-developed set of opinions, has such an evidentiary basis. It's like predicting who's going to get to the Super Bowl. You never know. But I do think they look for their vehicles. They want to take a vehicle they think is right for their point of view.
Do you think that the relative narrowness, I know you don't really feel it was a particularly narrow ruling based on what you said at the beginning, but the fact that it's the decision that it is, and it's not saying that marriage is a fundamental right, something that would affect the entire country, does that make it more or less likely for the court to take it up?
You know, narrows in the eye of the beholder, right? Brown versus Board of Education was just one school district in Arkansas. There wasn't any need to review it. And when they ruled, by the way, it was just one school district in Arkansas. It became the basis for the entire desegregation movement. This is a narrow ruling only in the sense that every case only affects the parties before it. You will see people using this opinion, regardless of what happens in the next couple of weeks, as a basis for their arguments in other states.
All right. Steve in Oakland, thanks so much for the call. Let's go down to San Jose. Liz is on the line. Good evening, Liz.
Yes, hi. I hope I can make this tidy because it's a little confused in my mind. A friend of mine's uncle is a bankruptcy judge in Los Angeles, and he ruled and got a prize from some gay group in L.A. that there should be no reason that gay bankruptcies should be treated differently from married heterosexual bankruptcies.
Bankruptcy between the two married partners who are of the same gender, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so does this kind of thing. So that one's established. I mean, this is...
Yeah.
Is there any effect of that sort of thing on this case or how the
Court
might go?
And Kate Kendall, that raises a larger question, too, about the Defense of Marriage
right.
Act and DOMA.
Right. And I do. It's easy to be confused about really what's going on and what the status of things are. So we should separate what happened today. The Prop 8 case is a marriage case. This is about winning the right to marry for same-sex couples. The bankruptcy case that you're talking about is about recognition cases. These are couples who are already married, and bankruptcy, immigration, health care, federal benefits, those cases that are challenging the Defense of Marriage Act are about trying to undo a federal law that says even if you're married, the Defense of Marriage Act will not recognize your marriage for purposes of federal benefits. So there are two tracks on which these issues are percolating now in the lower courts and headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. One is the marriage cases themselves, the right to marry cases, and the other is to strike down DOMA for couples who are already married to win federal recognition.
And there was another case filed, I think, just last week in Los Angeles, I believe it was, a veteran who has MS as part of her duty in Kuwait, I believe it was. And she's also, now that Don't Ask, Don't Tell has been eliminated, suing on that basis in DOMA. So, Rory Little, it's possible global, that maybe the case in Massachusetts, which I think is the furthest along, challenging DOMA, that one of those cases could get to the Supreme Court first. What impact would that have?
Yeah, the timing of when cert petitions are going to get there, and this is an interesting question all by itself, any cert petition filed right now is not going to get to the Supreme Court until next fall. Their spring schedule is already set, and they don't hear arguments from April to October. So they can collect actually 5 or 6 cert petitions over the next 6 or 7 months and decide which one to grant. And by the way, they could grant more than one if they really wanted to reach and decide the issue. If you think about this somewhat strategically, and some of the justices will do that, and you favor same-sex marriage, you may think you'll never get a better record. I mean, you've got a 4-vote, we think, plurality in favor of gay marriage. And what they're hoping is if the case gets up there, Tony Kennedy or Chief Justice Roberts will not be able to ignore the historical force of the claim. You don't want to be the justice who writes Plessy versus Ferguson. You want to be the justice who writes the other side.
Or Bowers v. Hardwick.
Or Bowers v. Hardwick, which Justice Scalia endorsed so strongly. And then the next thing you know, they overruled it. It's important. So if you've got those 4 votes, you might say, I'm not going to get a better record because I had a trial. And the other side was permitted to put on any evidence they wanted, and they didn't do it. So the other cases, DOMA cases, tend to not be based on trial records. So this may be the best vehicle. Who knows what will happen?
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Liz. Again, the number to call if you want to join us this hour, 866-733-6786. Joining us now by phone, John Eastman. He's chair of the National Organization for Marriage, also a law professor, former dean at Chapman University School of Law in Orange, California. Professor Eastman, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me on the program.
What is your sense of this ruling today? I mean, do you see it as a radical departure from what other courts have done with regard to marriage, or is it sort of an incremental step recognizing how opinions are changing in this country?
Well, I do think it's a radical departure. I mean, the court has now imposed something despite the fact that opinion in California had not changed. I mean, the fact that the people voted for Proposition 8 in one of the more liberal states in the country, here in California, indicates that the political process has not changed so much. In fact, every time this has gone to a vote of the people, traditional marriage has been upheld. So this is the court saying to the people of the state of California, you no longer have a say in making the basic policy determination of what kind of institution marriage is going to be. But I do have to take issue with some of the comments that have been made, that the proponents of the initiative put in nothing into the evidentiary record. I mean, that's just patently false. I mean, the record has got thousands and thousands of pages indicating, for example, if you allow same-sex marriage, it's a breathtakingly subversive idea. It will introduce an implicit revolt against the institution of marriage into its very heart.
But that's an opinion.
If same-sex marriage becomes legal, that venerable institution will ever after stand for sexual choice, for cutting the link between sex and diapers. And it will weaken the social norms that define people behavior in marriage. That right there, that evidence right there, is more than sufficient to support a rational basis for government to continue to adhere to traditional marriage. And yet none of that evidence is cited by Judge Reinhardt. And yet under rational basis review, which we have to apply here, you don't even have to have an evidentiary record. You just have to have reasonable grounds on which one might conceive of supporting it. And here this is in the evidentiary record.
Now, what about you said that the court undid the will of the people, but isn't that exactly what the Supreme Court did when they undid Amendment 2 in the Romer v. Evans case?
Well, they did. And, so the question is this different than Amendment 2? And unlike Amendment 2, this does not specify that gays and lesbians are not entitled to certain benefits. It says one man and one woman, for example. So it is applicable to plural marriages. It is just the same-sex marriages. It restored what had always been the case in California since the founding of the state, and that, too, is part of the trial record below. The cases in California that recognize the importance of procreation as the essence of marriage go right back to the 1850s in this state, and repeated as recently as 2008 in California case law. So the notion that we've taken some longstanding right away, when everybody knows that it was something created by the California Supreme Court just months before this initiative was adopted, I think is a bit of a stretch. And yet Judge Reinhardt has staked the entire opinion on that easily disprovable claim. So, you know, it's going to be an interesting fight as it goes up to the Supreme Court. I do agree with the professor from Hastings that there's a good record here. There are strong opinions, both the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion on this case. It doesn't seem that there would be much more to be gained by going to an en banc review. And I expect a cert petition by the proponents to be filed within the 90-day window to the Supreme Court of the United States. And I actually do expect that the Supreme Court will take this issue, despite Judge Reinhardt's efforts to write it so narrowly to save himself from another reversal from the Supreme Court or to save himself from the court even taking the case. David Boies and I were on PBS earlier today, and he acknowledged that the underlying principles that support Judge Reinhardt's opinion are profound and have national implication, and I think the Supreme Court will easily see that.
All right, John Eastman from National Organization for Marriage. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. Let's go now to Berkeley, and Nancy is on the line. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You sort of touched on my question, which was, mostly, you know, who wants to be on the wrong side of history? And I was wondering if the panelists, and by the way, I do support NCLR. Thank you, Kate. I do have an opinion. but I was just curious about even the conservative justices. Like, I would think that if they decided to uphold this, if they upheld Prop 8, eventually it would get, you know, overturned, and they would look like the people who voted for P. versus Ferguson or, you know, Bowers v. Hardwick, and that they would look kind of dumb historically.
Yeah.
So I was just curious if that really is a factor.
Well, let me put that to John Eastman, because we've heard what Rory Little had to say about that. But, you know, you have Anthony Kennedy, who everyone seems to think is the swing judge, as he is on so many issues. He's written two pretty strong and historic rulings in support of gay rights. Lawrence v. Texas on sodomy and the Romer case we've been talking about from Colorado. Why would he then turn 180 and uphold Prop 8?
Well, you know, he went out of his way in Lawrence versus Texas not to reach the question of marriage and not to write an opinion that dispositively addressed that issue. And I think there's easily a distinction in Justice Kennedy's kind of libertarian views about criminalizing private adult conduct and ratifying the relationship that is formed by that conduct as a societal norm that ought to be advanced completely irregardless of the tie to the biological complementarity of the sexes. And, you know, so we can flip the question around. Do you, you know, from the progressive side, it's, do you want to be the judge that stops this progressive trend towards same-sex marriage? On the other side, do you want to be the judge that completely, and again, I'll use the language from the trial record, that destroys the institution of marriage, that takes that venerable institution and forever cuts the links that made it the institution that was the importance to civil society? Do you want to
how would it destroy
the consequences that flow from that?
Yeah.
Question?
Yes, go ahead. Yeah, Nancy.
Does the Equal Protection Clause not apply to every citizen of California and the United States? That's my question.
It of course does. And as Judge Corrigan said on the California Supreme Court, who herself is reportedly a member of the gay and lesbian community, she said the Equal Protection Clause requires that we treat people that are similarly situated similarly. And she says it's just not true that opposite sex and same-sex couples are similarly situated with respect to marriage when one of the purposes of marriage is procreation, which can only be done unassisted between people of opposite sex. It is no aspersion one way or the other to state that basic biological fact. And under rational basis review, to pass equal protection scrutiny, that's all you need. And yet it's even more profoundly important than that, because this is the institution that civil society has relied on for perpetuating the species and for procreating and rearing the children that are necessary to do so. It's no aspersion to say that people that don't participate in that in the same way are somehow outside of that institution. That's the purpose of the institution. And what we're talking about here is the court mandating a radical transformation of the very purpose of that core institution.
All right.
I don't think that's the role of the courts.
All right, Nancy, thanks. Oh, I'm sorry to cut you off. We're getting short on time. I want to bring some other callers in, but whether or not Carol Corrigan is gay or lesbian, which is news to me, at least it is a...
That's why I put the word reportedly.
Reportedly.
You know, I don't know either. It has appeared in the newspaper, but she said that about equal protection in the California Supreme Court, and I think it was a very wise statement.
And she did vote to uphold Prop 8 as well. But Roy Little, there were two other questions decided today, and they got kind of short shrift. But one of them is this question, the motion to vacate the ruling because Vaughn Walker, the trial judge, did not reveal that he was in a same-sex relationship until after the trial. What do you make of that?
Yeah, you know, that notion was really smacked down, I'd like to say.
And that was a unanimous
using
decision.
A legal term, yeah, smacked down by the three judges. They were unanimous on that point. And they said substantially for the reasons set forth by the district court judge, Judge Ware. And the idea that a gay man who's in a long-term relationship is so influenced by this that he couldn't be fair is defied, really. I mean, really, this one really enrages me. A married heterosexual man is presumably threatened by gay marriage, if you believe the defense of marriage concept. A single man who might like to get married to anybody might be threatened. You've got to have judges who can decide these issues, and Judge Walker's sexuality or his relationship status, by the way, which was pretty well known to all the parties all the way through, and nobody raised an objection. So they rejected that. The other is standing, the question of whether there's a personal interest here. California Supreme Court took care of that a few months ago when they ruled that indeed the proponents, the official proponents of a proposition, have the same interest as the Attorney General in defending that proposition.
But couldn't the Supreme Court, if they wanted, deny standing based on the federal Constitution?
They could do that, and it would be an interesting – I don't think they will, because they would have to say that the states do not have authority to give the power to defend their initiatives to whoever they want to. In other words, the state could have given this authority to the treasurer or to the local dog catcher, and it's a question of state law who has the authority to defend.
But didn't that case come up, and we're digressing a little bit here, but I think it was the English-only ballot
measure
in Arizona.
Yeah, the Arizona case. But all they said there is we have grave doubts, and in that case there was no evidence that Arizona would have given that sort of interest. You've got to take the other side of this. It may be that denying standing is the best result for the proponents of Prop 8. That would constrain this to California. If you denied standing, you would vacate everything all the way back, give the plaintiffs a default judgment, strike down Prop 8 with no opinion. And then they would have their narrow decision.
And it would be really narrow, wouldn't it? Because it was not a class action lawsuit. Could it only apply to those two couples, the two plaintiffs?
Doubtful. I mean, I think you'd strike down Prop 8, but you'd strike it down without all this language that they don't like.
Yeah. All right. Let's go back to the phones. Anna in Oakland. Hi. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering why we're spending all this time and effort trying to define or redefine marriage, which originated as a religious institution, instead of making the civil union the institution that provides equal protection from legal perspective, economic perspective, and also I think we should allow heterosexual couples to join in a civil union. And I'll take my answer up there.
Thank you so much. Kay Kendall, that's in fact how it's done in many countries around the world, in Europe, I know for sure.
Yes, people have made this argument a lot, and, you know, it does have some appeal to say, look, everyone who wants the state to sanction their union should be in a civil union or a domestic partnership, and then if you want your church to recognize your relationship, that's a marriage. You know, and that has some appeal, you know, sort of a libertarian, a pragmatic approach, but it's just not how we do things in this country. In this country, people get married, and they call their union a marriage. And so to have one category of people, and only one category of people, that is same-sex couples, denied the right to call their relationships a marriage, have them recognized as a marriage by the state, that is what creates the constitutional problem. Now, if everyone would agree, including all heterosexual couples, that yes, what we have with each other is a civil union, well, you know, then we could be again talking. But until that happens, you know, we're not going to bid against ourselves. We want to marry.
Well, go ahead.
I just want to say one thing. This is where the trial record and the discovery record is so important. And John Eastman, I think, is right about the fact that there is a long record here. The proponents of Proposition 8 admitted in discovery the following. They said the word marriage has a unique meaning and there is a significant symbolic disparity between domestic partnership and marriage. So even the proponents here recognize that protecting marriage, if you want to call it that, is a valuable point. And that's the point of the rational basis test. Why would you deny that benefit, whatever it is, symbolic or otherwise? You've got to have a rational basis.
There was a bit of humor in the decision today, too, when one of the Justice Reinhardt said that the Marilyn Monroe movie was not called How to Register a Domestic Partnership with a Millionaire, pointing out that, you know, it's not as sexy. It doesn't have that same cachet that marriage
well,
does.
Well, he quotes, I think it's Frank Sinatra, as a man doesn't know what happens until he's married. Doesn't know what happiness is until he's married. By then, it's too late.
All right. Let's see if we can sneak another call in here. Mario and Benicia, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a couple of points. One, I wanted to correct the statement that the right to marriage was taken away in the state of California. Actually, it's the other way around. The people of the state of California had already passed an amendment that defined what marriage was. That was challenged by Mayor Newsom, and that's what eventually led to Proposition 8 and then to the point that we're at today. Also, I see this as an attack on a marriage. I do not, and I take offense to anybody that says that I do this in anger or hatred towards gay people. I do not hate gay people at all. In fact, I strongly support laws that prevent the harassment of these people. But at the same time, you have to look at the basis of what marriage was in the beginning. What predated marriage? It wasn't the law, it was religion. And the law came substantially later in time to get involved in the Marriage Act itself.
All right, Mario, so, I do appreciate your point. We're getting short on time, but I do appreciate the call and glad you did call. We do have just a couple minutes left, and I wanted to just point out that, as I said at one point this week, Washington State may pass gay marriage. The governor there has said she would sign it. There may be a referendum to try and reverse that, but. Roy Little and Kay Kendall, what difference does it make that other states could be moving toward gay marriage as this percolates through the courts?
Well, my view is that it just shows you're at a historical junction right now on this issue, and that this is why it's ripe for the Supreme Court to make a ruling that it's a protected idea. You're still going to have legislative developments no matter how that comes out.
Yeah. And Kate Kendall, there is still a push, and there are some people in California who support same-sex marriage who want to put it back on the ballot. There's talk about, I think, even maybe there may even be a petition out on the streets now to collect signatures for November. Isn't there a good case to be made that maybe that is the best way to resolve this, is to let the voters repeal Prop 8?
And I think the voters would repeal Prop 8. I think the polling is all showing that the tide is changing, and there is inevitability. I mean, the opponents can say all they will. It's very clear that people's views are changing. Mario is certainly entitled to his religious views. Every religion is entitled to their views. What we're talking about is social policy, and are we going to protect people, and does the Constitution's promise apply to everyone?
All right, and we are going to have to leave it there. Thanks to you, Kay Kendall, from the National Center for Lesbian Rights, for coming in. Thanks also to Rory Little from the UC Hastings College of the Law, and to all of our guests and to our listeners as well for calling in tonight. And you have been listening to a special broadcast on the Prop 8 ruling from KQED News. Stay tuned to KQED for ongoing coverage of this issue, and you'll find much more news online at kqednews.org. Our director tonight is Susie Rocho. The engineer is Seal Muller. The producer is Polly Stryker, and we had production assistance from Thomas Gorman. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening. Good night.